Welcome to a very special edition of the Original Gangsters Members Only Podcast. Myself, my podcasting partner in crime, Novi Toko, former Detroit Mafia button man. We are joined by a very special guest, Jamie Lawton, former G-man, former FBI agent on the East Coast out of Connecticut. Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And
welcome, Jamie.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
We are lucky that Jamie is going to go through the whole mafia NBA college basketball scandal that broke last year that we've been way on top of here at Original Gangsters going back to 2025 when we were the first ones in the country to tell everybody that this sprawling point fixing scandal involving the NBA and the NCAA had ties to the mafia in New York. Mainstream media came out with that about 8 months later. And now the case is about to get, you know, into the court system now. So it's three separate cases that have all kind of come together in this major NBA mafia point shaving scandal, as well as a poker fixing scandal that they use to get people in debt to then get them to shave points. So we wanted to get Jamie's take on all of this from a federal law enforcement perspective. Novi's given a little bit of insight from a organized crime perspective, but we're going to kind of deep dive this thing now. Jamie, give us your initial impressions of this thing. For over 40 co-defendants, six states, 36 college basketball programs, over 40 games spread out amongst the NCAA, the NBA, and the Chinese basketball league.
Well, the first thing to remember in this case, this scandal, is this. Basketball has always been the easiest team sport to fix because you really only need one guy.
Wow.
And one of the things that appeals to whoever your guy that you're controlling is, you don't have to lose the game to make money. You just have to shave points. So that's why when you're approaching one guy to get him to not hit every one of his three throws or not hit every one of his three pointers, it appeals to them, to their conscience, because they don't have to tank the game to make money. They can win the game and get bribed at the same time and keep everybody happy. So that's why that's why basketball is an easy sport. It's the easiest team sport to fix. Football is a very difficult team sport to fix because there's so many people involved and there's too many variables. Basketball, it's obviously been fixed in the past with Boston College and Henrik Smith and at the high school level. And here we are again. This is a little different because now you have online betting services that you can make prop bets. And for listeners that don't know what that means,
betting
on an individual player's performance as opposed to whether or not the team's going to win. And, you know, when I first talked to Scott about this, I said there's an easy fix to this thing, that the betting services have to stop having prop bets for individual players. And they're never going to do that because they're making money hand over
fist. Too much money. Those right at this point in time in 2026. The prop bets are considerably more made than the regular bets. It's not even close.
So one of the things I told Scott, I mean, I did a bookmaking phone a long time ago. This is in the infancy of online and computerization and online services being involved in bookmaking. And back then, as you guys probably recall, all the servers were over in Costa Rica. They weren't here in the United States. So it was a good setup for the mob because the servers over there couldn't be searched and they couldn't be seized. So what would happen is you'd have a guy in, let's say he was here in New Haven or in Detroit. You'd go to your guy, your bookmaker, and he'd give you a passcode. You'd go on your computer, you'd make your bets, and he kind of had a master account where he could follow all the action. And then whether you won or lost, you'd go to your bookmaker and he'd settle up with you, or you paid him. That's the way it was back then.
No,
that was in the Stone Age next to what's going on right now.
The last bust out of Luciano's, which is the big, Jamie, it's the big Italian restaurant. It's the best Italian restaurant on the East Side. It's where a lot of the wise guys eat, as well as just regular people. The most recent bust out of Luciano's was a Pete Tocco's guys, Tommy Mackey, using one of these Costa Rica websites to send people to.
Well, let me tell you, that's been a while that they've been using Costa Rica and all that. Jamie's absolutely right that basketball, because you got 20% of the game in one player. And with prof bets are so profitable because they make you bet more money. The idea of this massive return and the more you bet, the more you lose. I mean, that's just the rule of gambling, you know? And I'll quote a bookmaker. The more you bet, the more you lose, you know? And the less you bet, the more you lose when you win. And that's an old bookmaker taught me that a long time ago.
So let me run this past Novi and see what he thinks. So I did this bookmaking phone. I was never a big gambler, particularly back then since it was illegal. Now, obviously, it's legal, but I was never a real big gambler. But in interacting with the people that bet a lot, I kind of put it, I made this up in my own head, but I put everybody into four categories. Either you're a pedestrian, a prepper, a degenerate, or an action junkie. I'll explain that to you. I'm a pedestrian. I bet $100 on football this year. I bet that the Patriots are going to win more than 8 games.
Okay.
That was my only bet for the entire season. You're not going to make, if you're a bookmaker, you ain't making any money on me.
No, you're absolutely not. They're not making money on a pedestrian. You're right.
You're not making. The next guy, the next set of guys is the preppers. They're going to make 2-3 bets a weekend. They're going to research the living shit out of it. They're going to find out what quarterback, how does this quarterback do against this defense? They're going to really research it. They're going to bet more money, but they're going to make educated bets. If you're a bookmaker, you're going to lose to them sometimes. You're going to win with them sometimes, but you're still not going to make a whole lot of money. The third category is where the bookmakers make all their money, and that's the degenerates. That's where all your money is. And what's interesting about degenerate gamblers is this. A lot of times, they're people that, in their civilian job, they make a lot of money, but they're bored out of their mind. They're building contractors. They're plumbing contractors. They do a mundane job that they do well for a lot of money, but they're bored with it. They're looking for something interesting and exciting. So what do? You start betting on football. You start betting on basketball. That's the excitement that a lot of restaurant owners, they get bored being at the restaurant all day long. I had a victim like that. He was into a Gambino associate for over $100,000. And he told me when I interviewed him, he said, Jamie, I own 2 pizza places. I'm bored out of my mind. My gambling is my excitement. And then you have the fourth category, who's the most interesting, particularly pertaining to what we're talking about. I call them action junkies. Firefighters, cops.
Athletes.
Anybody does anything
athletes,
dangerous.
Jamie, athletes.
That's the part of this thing I'm getting to.
Yeah.
Those are the guys. Athletes are action junkies. And I told Scott this story, Novi, and I'll tell you the story. Tom Brady obviously is an action junkie. He's not a gambler, but he's an action junkie. So he's very competitive. This is probably 10 or 11, 12 years ago. The Pats have a game in San Francisco, and then they have a game in Mexico City. So Belichick decides to put him up in a hotel after the 49er game, and then he's going to fly him down to Mexico City so they don't have to come back across the United States. So everybody knows Tuesday is the day off in the NFL. That's your day off if you're a player. On the Monday night, Pats players rent out this huge banquet room. Only players, no coaches. After the steak dinner that they had, they decide they're going to have a chug-a-lug contest. Chug-a-lug and big pints of beer, big glasses of beer. They take one of the glasses. Every single player throws in $100. They put it down. Whoever wins the chug-a-lug contest gets all the money. Brady chug-a-lugs like 12 or 13 beers and wins the contest. And the guy was telling the story, basically said, I've never seen the guy eat an M&M. I've never seen him doing it. We didn't even know he drank. Nobody had. The reason he did it is he was addicted to the action of winning that money. That's how action junkies are. They love to compete, and it's part of what they do. And part of being a competitive guy is to gamble. It's part of what they do. One of my closest friends' brother-in-law is a pro golfer. He's a former pro golfer. One of the things he told me, I'll never forget this. He was on the tour in the 90s. I'm sorry, the 80s. Late 80s, early 90s. And he said the amount of gambling that PGA players do is insane. Out of control.
Insane.
Gambling among the PGA has always been a lot.
Yeah. Well, Jamie, I don't know if you know this, and that's a quick aside. You know, Phil Mickelson was betting through Detroit through some of the guys that Novi used to work with. And all of it came out in a court case somewhat recently, even though it happened 20 years ago. And Detroit stiffed him because the guy that was middling the bets owed Detroit money. So the Detroit guys were like, this is your problem. This ain't our problem. And Mickelson was stiff $500,000.
So I don't know. So the year that I did my phone, I think it was 2000, maybe 6 or 7. During our phone, I looked at the pen register, and one of our target numbers was bouncing off a number in Detroit. I called the agent in Detroit. We were talking, and he said that they were up on a bookmaker's, where they were pen register. They had a pen register on a bookmaker's phone, and they were targeting him because he had a Sharpie that was contacting somebody in NFL headquarters.
It was Allen, probably.
Huh?
It was either Allen Hilf or Joe D.
Or Freddie Sale.
I don't know what happened with the case. I never forgot.
Freddie was out of the game.
Yeah. And then, I'm going to agree with Jamie on that. Action junkies, but a lot of the degenerate gamblers are action junkies. Yeah, and their action is... Yeah, and their action is betting more money than you can afford to lose.
So I'll tell you, so when you say that, Novi, I played American football when I was a serviceman in Germany, and I learned how to speak some German, and I also studied it in college. And the Germans have a saying that I think pertains to this conversation we're having, and it's Angst ist nie langweilig, which means fear is never boring. So if you make a $10,000 bet, that's your mortgage payment or your three mortgage payments. You make that on a Monday night football game and you're watching that game, you're not going to get bored because you're afraid of what's going to happen if you lose that game.
And that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Fear never gets boring. The only thing I'm going to disagree with you, Jamie, is that player that bets 3, 4, 5 games a week through the whole football season is bread and butter to the average bookmaker. The average bookmaker doesn't have 800 or 900 clients. They have 25, they have 50, they have 100. And you'd be surprised how those $100 bets add up at the end of the day. And when the game goes right, you end up making good money every week on those during the football season. Now, the baseball season, you don't have that, so there's no volume. You don't have that many of players. People don't bet baseball like they bet football. Basketball doesn't get interesting until March Madness, and then you have the number of players that all those three, four, five guys a week add up at the end of the week to a number of bets, and you make a good living with them.
So when you're a set, we're talking about, so when you were in the game, Novi, which is a long time ago.
Yeah, for anybody that doesn't know, Novi tapped out in like 2001, but was active from a pretty young age because of who his family was. So let's say Novi, 1965 to 2000-ish.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was always involved with gambling in those days. Yeah.
My assessment of this whole thing, I think you'll agree, is there's a lot of things with betting on, like a lot of things have changed, but there's some stuff that's never going to change. It's always going to be the same type of thing. And one of the things that I think that OC Figures is still involved in is, even with DraftKings and all these other betting sites, sooner or later, your customers are going to run out of money and they're going to need somebody to borrow
credit.
Money from.
Credit.
That's right, credit. You got to remember all those other places you're putting up money. But when you call the bookmaker, the illegal bookmaker, it's you're on a credit line. And a good bookmaker knows how to rate his customers and knows how to just rate him for his mad money. But and all the bookmakers don't know how to do that, but the ones that have been around, the Alan Hills and the Freddie Salem and the Joe D's in Detroit, they all knew how to rate their customers. And you're right. Even when the legality started, they were getting customers that had tapped out with the legal places because they were putting up money. So now they had to go to the illegal guy because they got that credit.
Well, and Novi, tell me if you agree with this, and Jamie as well. I think there's something about an older generation gambler, let's say the last 10 years, 15 years, that is used to, as opposed to the guys that are in their 20s and 30s now that have just started to bet more in modern times. But for guys that are, even people that are my age that were betting before the real onset of internet betting, there's something about getting money in your hand that's different than getting money in a digital account. And there's some people that just like to go see their bookie every Tuesday and settle up.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely true. And then in Michigan, I don't know about other states, Jamie, maybe you do know, but in Michigan, if you cannot deduct your losses against your winnings for the Michigan income tax. So if you win $10,000 one week and lose $9,000 the next week, you pay taxes on $10,000.
Yep.
Now, so, in the federal government, that's different. If you can prove the losses, you can take the losses against gambling winnings. Now, I don't know what they are in other states because I've been out of the game since it's gone legal. But every time the government sticks their hands in a gambling place, they're taking more money than the illegal guys are taking.
Let's go through some of the particulars of this conspiracy, because I want to get Jamie's opinion and Novi's analysis. Novi and I have spoken a little bit about some of this, but this whole thing. ESPN broke the fact that there was this wide-reaching point-shaving conspiracy involving the NBA and college basketball. So that news broke in January of 2025. So we've known that this conspiracy has been in existence for roughly a year. We didn't know the mafia angle, as I said at the beginning of the show, until, you know, I reported it, but I have a relatively small audience compared to, you know, mainstream media. But the masses didn't really know about the mob angle, let's say, until October. But when I looked at the ESPN report, and this was really when I piggybacked my reporting off of their initial report, and I saw the numbers that were being thrown around in terms of the money that was behind this conspiracy, the amount of games that were being fixed, the amount of people that were involved in the fixing, the fact that it went from California to New York and back. And then they identify in the ESPN article this, at that time, a 39-year-old Pittsburgh native named Sugar Shane Hennen as the mastermind. And I don't see anything related to organized crime in this reporting. I said to myself, my first takeaway was there's no way a 39-year-old kid from Pittsburgh could organize the level of fix that this was with so many different layers without a bankroll that he could not by himself put together. There has to be organized crime behind him. And pretty quickly, I was able to find out that there was. What's your initial reaction about a 40-year-old guy who was not a made member of the mafia? How the genesis of this fascinates me, that this 40-year-old kid could come up with the vision that this was.
When you're a guy like that, you're never more than three people away from the mob. You're going to be able to know, to go to somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody that's connected to a family.
Well, he grew up around the Pittsburgh mafia, which doesn't really exist today. Novi and his family were involved pretty heavily with the Pittsburgh guys. When I say family, I don't necessarily mean the mob family, but Novi's like uncles and grandfather and everything. So Shane grew up around old school Pittsburgh mob bookies and loan sharks and drug dealers. So he definitely had that background.
So, you know, you can, if he's going to them and saying, hey, I have a player that'll start tanking prop bets, or I know a guy who knows a player that's going to start shaving his prop bets, you can bet your ass the mob's going to be in on that instantaneously.
Ears are going to be wide open.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with Jamie there. Somebody's going to find him and said, oh, we got to go get calf here.
Big time.
This is four of the five. So when the indictment finally came down, we're talking four of the five families in New York.
Right.
So this is very, very high stakes in terms of the people that are backing this. You have the two biggest names in terms of LCN figures in New York, Joe Lani, a.k.a. Joe Brooklyn, who represents the Sicilian Gambino ruling faction, and then Ernie Aiello, who's the day-to-day boss of the Bonanno crime family. So somehow Shane Hennen goes from a Pittsburgh mob associate associated to a family that doesn't exist anymore. He leverages the Pittsburgh guys that he grew up around. They have ties to the Gambinos. And just like you said, he probably goes to one of his uncles or mentors in the Pittsburgh mob, says, I have this plan. And they say, oh, look, let me take you to New York. And you tell this to the corporate office and get the financing for it.
I mean, Novi knows this. If you're running, let's say you're a capo, even a soldier, you're going to have guys under you, and all you want to hear all day long is, how are you earning money for this crew / this? What are you doing now? Oh, somebody comes walking through the door, and they have an NBA player who's willing to shave points. sit down, kid. Let's get going. Like that's what you're bringing to the table. So if he goes to, if you're a capital running the crew, and then this kid from Pittsburgh goes to an associate and says, "Hey, I got this thing I want to sell you." The associate's going to go to the soldier. The soldier's going to go to the capo, and everybody's going to get in on it.
Because oh, it's absolutely a way to earn. True. Absolutely true. You got to kick it up. But yeah, and the other thing is when you got when you can buy the prop bets, given that there's a legal gambling institutions. All that money, you're putting it into the legal people. So the money's coming out and you're putting money in your pocket that didn't come out of your circle. It came out of another pot. And that increases your pot. You know what I mean? You got to understand when your pie has got $1 billion and I just won $1 million out of another pot, I put it in my pot, you know, and it's more money for us to deal with.
Let's drill down for a moment on, dare I say, the brilliance of some of the way this was put together, and in the way that Hennin and the people around Hennin conceived what they would refer to and they would sell to their the players that they had their hooks into. They would sell what they called a soft fix, which was essentially something that not Novi himself, but the Detroit mob back in the 80s kind of pioneered a little bit of this with the shaving that they were allegedly doing with the Detroit Pistons. Novi was locked up when a lot of this was going on, but he was associated with the people that were doing it. And essentially, the soft fix means you're checking yourself out of the game. You're telling your coach you have an injury.
Yeah.
You're saying you don't feel well. You're checking yourself out either right before tip-off where the line can't move. You 2 minutes before tip-off, you say, I can't play today. Or there's a prop bet on you through the game saying, like Jamie said about a prop bet, you're betting on an individual player's performance. And one of the cases that's under investigation right now involves Terry Rozier, who's a NBA player on $100 million contract. So, you know, you're not talking about bench warmers. And Rozier had a prop in the game that said he was going to score 16 points and grab 8 rebounds. And at halftime, he had 12 points and 7 rebounds. And he just said to his coach, I'm not going to play in the second half. You got your prop bet just, you know, comes in for you, even though it was the trajectory of it was that it was going to go in the opposite direction. So this was a new way to save some of the younger fixers or the people that were fixing the younger guys and then the NBA guys to say to them, we're not asking you to lose a game. We're just asking you to check yourself out of a game.
Yeah.
That appeals to the player.
Oh yeah, because
he thinks he's not tanking the game. He's just taking himself out of the game,
right?
And so what do they care? You know, as long as we win the game, who cares if I sat out the second half? And the other problem that the NBA has with this is with the way they're doing load management now.
Yep,
and they're also sitting there. You know, one of the things that the NBA commissioner is looking into is teams are unabashedly tanking games at the end of the year to get better draft picks. I mean, it's a big problem in the NBA right now. So what you're doing by the NBA themselves, by admitting that you're doing that, is you're saying, okay, well, we're not going to win this game, so we get something good out of it. So how's the players going to say to themselves, well, what do you care if I don't play the second half of a regular season game and I make some money out of it? What do you care? You're doing the same thing. You're trying to make your team better by tanking games.
Yeah.
So the NBA is justifying what players that are on the take are doing.
I want to emphasize by doing, Jamie, you made a great point about the load management, and that plays in to one of these games that's being, or I shouldn't even say being looked at. These games have been charged. We haven't, they have not been adjudicated yet, but there have been charges. And one of those charges was a LeBron James load management game. Now, nobody's, I want to be clear, nobody's accusing LeBron James of intentionally sitting out a game. But the knowledge that LeBron James was not going to play in that game had not reached Vegas to affect the spread. And according to this indictment, somebody in NBA coaching circles knew that he wasn't going to play and fed that information to the Gambinos for them to make a bet on the Lakers, knowing that LeBron wasn't going to be in the lineup. So it plays right into the load management stuff. Whether or not you as the player that's being load managed know about the betting and the fixing or not, people in your organization know you're going to play, you're not going to play, and that information is valuable.
I'm a little bit disappointed with some of the security, the team security with these NBA teams.
Yes, great point.
Why aren't they paying closer attention to who their players are interacting with? They can't dig into their personal lives too much, but you're not earning your money as a security director for an NBA team if you're not paying attention to who your players are hanging around with. You have to do that.
If the NFL can do that when you're keeping track of 100 guys, the NBA should be able to do it when you're keeping track of 12. And I mean team by team.
You're right.
And well, there's a difference. There's also a mind difference here. These younger pro athletes are a more independent-minded person than they were 25, 30, 35 years ago. Yep. They don't want to be told what to do. They're harder to coach, and they're harder to keep track of. So I'm going to defend some of this security a little bit. But I do agree with Jamie in that, and you, Scott, that they should be doing more. But you got to remember, these kids are making millions of dollars, and they are already more difficult to coach, more difficult. They see themselves as victims more often than pampered players. They see themselves as a victim of Big Brother. And that's part of it, so that it makes it more difficult for these security people to keep tabs on them.
So, and this was split. This was split between the NBA and the NCAA, which is another reason that this is such a unicorn. When I just keep on talking about the vision of Hennen to pull this off, it's really astounding that he could put this thing all together, get it up and running for at least 2 or 3 years. They've probably made, dare I say, hundreds of millions of dollars over the time period of these fixes. And another aspect of this that was very, very strategic, and I guess I'm giving Shane Hennen a lot of credit. He's a real degenerate in terms of a person. His story to how he ended up as the mastermind of this is in some ways more interesting than him being the mastermind. And this guy was persona non grata from multiple cities. He had been run out of the East Coast. His name was mud with his people in Pittsburgh. He went to Philadelphia. He got in trouble in Philadelphia. He gets run out of Pennsylvania with a contract on his head because he owes so much money. He's cooperated with law enforcement, and that starts to seep out. Somehow that knowledge doesn't make its way to the people that are doing the fixing, and that's another story. But he is on the outs in the early 2010s. And by the mid to late 2010s, he finds his way to Las Vegas and kind of reinvents himself as a tout, as somebody that's, has an online presence and is giving out betting tips. And that's when some of this starts. And I think it's, from what I can gather, Hennon had done like some test runs before he went to the big guns in New York. And the test runs were done with players that he had cultivated by taking the money that he was making in drugs and gambling and putting it into summer basketball leagues with youth basketball. So he was meeting guys that would become future college basketball players and future NBA players by funding their AAU teams and their summer pro-ams and whatnot, and making relationships with black drug dealers who could get him access to black players because Sugar Shane was half Italian, half Irish. And then they start doing test runs in Chinese basketball in the Chinese league, and then very low level Division I, where in the fixers' minds and Shane and his people's minds, nobody was going to be paying attention to, you know, Southern Utah versus UC Santa Barbara, the way that they would be paying attention to Duke versus North Carolina. Can you guys kind of talk about that approach?
One of the reasons you're doing it is if you go to your mob contact, you want to be able to say to this guy, because you're looking to get those guys to kind of sort of invest in your idea.
No, finance the whole thing, basically.
And slash finance.
Right.
So you want to be able to go to them and say, listen, I just did this in Beijing in a Chinese league game, and I won this amount of money. And I did this, it was the Salukis versus, Northern Illinois.
Right.
They did it on that game, and here's how much. And you're basically submitting a resume to whoever your organized crime contact is that you've already made money doing this. So there, because it, and Novi knows, you're not going to throw a lot of money at this kid if you don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Well, absolutely not. You're absolutely right. That's got to be a fail safe. You know, you're not going to throw money at some goofball that comes up with a team. You want to prove that it's going to work.
Right. And, you know, you're a soldier. What family you're in, whatever family you're in, you're going to have guys coming at you with different scams and ideas about how to rip stuff all the time. And some of them, that could work. And some of them be like, get the hell out of here. This isn't even worth my time. You're wasting my time. That's why this guy did this, obviously. He wants to show whatever mob guy or investor he's going to that it's going to work.
I think another very, very interesting aspect of this, and it's really in some ways the linchpin of how this whole thing ended up biting all these big-time mob guys, and that is the age-old phenomena that cash can cure a lot of ills, right? So Shane Hennon was persona non grata. He could not come back to his hometown, could not come into his home state without worrying that somebody was going to kill him. He didn't have any money. He was thought of by some people as a cooperator and just could not come back home. Once he reinvents himself and starts making a little bit of money on the Chinese basketball fixes and the low-level D1 fixes, he has some money. And he's able to come back home and get this thing off the ground by getting that introduction to the Gambinos by returning with cash and making good with all the people that wanted to do him harm. He comes, pays them, pays them back. They get even and say, well, guess what? I'm not just going to pay you back. I'm not just paying you back the money that I owed you from 5 years ago. I'm going to bring you a golden goose that's laying golden eggs. And none of these people that he's pitching this to do a simple Google search on him, and a simple Google search on Shane Hennon would have told you that he had cooperated in a cocaine case against a mob guy in Pittsburgh. And nobody that goes over that, that goes over under everybody's noses. So the second Shane Hedden gets pinched last winter, he cooperates on the spot.
Cash and is a lot of times that happens is because it's they're greedy. They're not, they're all they're thinking about is the money. They're not thinking about logic. They're not thinking about being safe. They're not thinking about, and I got to check this guy out. I'm going to look around on this guy. They just want the money.
I just, so the guy comes out of nowhere. It's not like the Gambinos have been working with him before. And by the way, the Gambinos then introduce him to the Bananos and the Lucchese's and the Genovese. So they were so blinded by the pitch that he had given them. And obviously he had shown them some of what they what you would call, I guess, in the business world, proof of concept, that it looked like they talked to the Pittsburgh guys and the Pittsburgh guys vouched for them, whether or not these Pittsburgh guys knew about Hennen's prior cooperation. I got to believe they did, but everybody pushed it to the side because there was so much money to be made.
Well, you know, obviously this kid gets pinched and he flips, and that's that, you know, we're all, how many times have you seen this movie as an agent, or, you know, he cooperated.
They pulled him off a plane. So, he heard that a bus was coming down. He got like $15,000 in cash and some fake passports and fake IDs. And he was on a plane in Las Vegas, ready to go to Columbia. And the FBI pulled him off the plane, arrested him. And he started cooperating at the airport, allegedly.
You sit down with a guy like that and you tell him the same thing that we used to always say. The first one to dive in the pool gets the best swim. The first cooperator who flips gets the best deal. The guys who wait around to see what's going on, they'll do okay, but they're not going to do as good as the first guy. It's just not. First guy's looking at a walk or a very lenient sentence.
And they saw bigger fish. And they saw, you know, we know, Jamie, nobody can talk about it from one side of it. You can talk about it from another side of it. When agents make big cases, when prosecutors make big cases, when there are heads to put on a wall that everybody knows, the next step is a promotion and a climbing up the ladder.
I mean, you sit down with a guy like that and you go, listen, we don't just got you good, we got you beautiful. You're done. You're absolutely done. Here's our recording. Here's our video. Here's our stuff. You show it to them. You're basically putting on a little bit of a dog and pony show. You're saying, your lawyer's sitting here. We're going to give you 60 minutes to make a decision. We'll leave in the conference room. The marshals are right outside. If you want to get out of here, you can. We're going to give you an hour to make a decision. If you're not interested within an hour, we're just moving on to the next guy. That's how you do it. You put pressure on them. Most of the time, they're going to say, "Yeah, okay, we'll cooperate," and then you start your process. Well,
I would guess that the people that were arresting him had knowledge that he had cooperated in this coke case 15 years before that, so he might be open to talking to them about a much bigger case that could cause him a lot more harm, you know, from the judicial system.
You know, and you're going to get guys, and Novi knows them, you're going to get guys that you could blowtorch them and they're not going to cooperate.
Well, that's right. But the younger they get, I mean, the more modern they get, the more Americanized they are, that they're so willing to cooperate. And Jamie's right. The old timers, you could have got a blowtorch to their feet and you weren't getting a shit out of them. You know? Yep.
And listen, I mean, we all know when it comes to the drug game, the Godfather, Don Corleone and the Godfather was 100% right. He said that this drug dealing is going to destroy us in the future. And it really has. It's destroyed the mob because the sentences are so heavy, everybody flips. And that's, you know, but the problem that people don't understand, we're switching from gambling to drugs. The problem people don't understand, and this is different than, it's a different crime than bookmaking. Bookmaking is a very involved, very not complicated, but there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. There's a lot of work that needs to be done if you're going to run an office and be a bookmaker. When you talking about drugs, you can triple your money in 1 hour.
The margins are so much wider.
Jamie, you're exactly right. When you're a bookmaker, you work for a living. When you're a drug dealer, you spend all that money you made yesterday at the beach tomorrow, and I'll just go make some more tomorrow. And that's just the way it is, you know.
Yes.
Guys that I did time with, the drug dealers, they said, we used to shut down the whatever they were dealing, the heroin. He said, when we had so much money for the day, we didn't know what to do with it. We'd shut it down so we could go play. You know, bookmakers don't do that. Bookmakers are at their phone.
24/7. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're working a job, you know.
If you look at the New England crime fit, if you look at Boston, one of the funny side stories about Whitey Bulger is, He clipped, or guys he was working with clipped a couple of bookmakers and took their bookmaking operations over, and they screwed them all up because they didn't know how to do the job. It's not an easy job. You're on the phone all day long. You're collecting from people that don't want to pay you sometimes. You're tracking stuff down. You got to keep track of all the lines. It's a lot of phone work and stuff. It's not an easy crime to commit. It takes a lot of work and a lot of organization. Drug dealing is a snap.
Jamie, you're absolutely right. Bookmaking is a job, and it always has been. It's rather pleasant if you got a little gambling in your heart. It's a pleasant job, but it's a job. And it's, you go to work every day grinding it out.
Yep.
I just want to touch on one or two more things before we wrap up. I know Jamie's got to get out of here. First is, let's draw a line between Shane Hennon being arrested on the airplane in January of 25 and how the FBI investigating these point shaving conspiracies, how did they land at Shane Hennon's doorstep? And that would be back in 2023, the NBA player Jontay Porter from the Toronto Raptors cooperated and gave them Shane Hennon. So one of Shane Hennon's fixers who was in the NBA gave him up. And then that's how the dominoes fell from the Porter, the tip that they got that Jontay Porter was fixing in 23. Then they get Porter to cooperate, I think, at some point at the end of 23. 24, they start bringing a couple cases, and then Hennon gets nailed at the beginning of 25, and then the whole house comes down at the end of 25. So I just want to, what do you, any comments on that? The fact that the NBA player was the first one to start giving up these people, and then by this point now, there have been 36 different college players that have acknowledged that they were fixing on behalf of these guys. So one NBA player, 36 college players right now have admitted to being involved in this.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind is simply this. An NBA player, he's by his nature, even if he's doing something that's unethical and illegal, he's not a criminal by nature. He's an athlete. So if I know I'm screwed and I lawyer up, my lawyer's going to say, look, this is going to end up being a big scandal. You're going to be the first guy at the table. You're going to get the best deal. I think you should cooperate right now before anybody else beats you to the punch. I'll call the U.S. Attorney's office. I'll set it up. We'll go in for a proffer session. Tell them what you know, and then we'll go from there. So that's probably what led that Raptors player to cooperate. And then the Bureau did what the Bureau does, which is they started building a case. And then once they took the second facet of the case down, they did the same thing with the players that were involved in that. You're going to see, you're going to get a lot of people that are going to flip and they're going to cooperate and plead out in this thing.
And with Henin, he hits every mark that we were just talking about. He was a gambler. He was a card cheat. He was a drug dealer. He was a fixer. So this guy was like spread pretty thin in terms of what he was, you know, what lane he was in terms of being a criminal. We know, Novi and I talked about it briefly, that part of his cooperation, I've been able to get my hands on some of the documents, and he tried to come to Detroit. Shane Henin tried to come to Detroit with this. At least the if not the point shaving aspect of it, the card fixing aspect of it. And he had a meeting, and he was immediately told to leave town or they were going to hurt him. Like, we don't want anything to do with this. So the Detroit guys sniffed this thing out pretty quickly in terms of Henin.
Yeah, I remember that conversation. You're right. They told him to hit the road, Jack.
And I had wrongly identified who had brought him up there, a guy that Novi knew, Johnny Schroeder, who's finishing up a sentence right now and was in Novi's original case. And Johnny was doing business up in Pittsburgh. And I think some of the feds that I was getting information from did a little bit of, math in their head and said to me, well, Johnny had to be the one to bring Shane up there.
No, and then we heard Johnny.
Right. Then we heard from Johnny saying, I don't know what you're talking about. Stop saying that I had anything to do with Shane Henin.
Yeah.
But Henin admits in his debriefing that he went up to Detroit, had a meeting with the Jackalones, and was basically told that we don't want to do business with you. You should leave right now if you know it's good for your health. And this brings us to the final part of this conversation. And I just want to put out some things that are in the court filings that don't look good for the Detroit Pistons Hall of Fame point guard, Chauncey Billups, who's the biggest name in terms of the NBA. Terry Rozier has a big contract, but I don't think Terry Rozier is a household name. Chauncey Billups was a very well-known player, won a championship, Hall of Famer, has been a broadcaster. And before this case came down, he was the head coach of the Portland Trail Blazers. And this looks really bad for Chauncey. I mean, really bad. It doesn't look like Chauncey was a pawn that was being manipulated. It looks like Chauncey was doing the manipulating with the mob, getting people that he knew into card games that Chauncey realized were fixed, that he was telling these guys that he knew and was friends with that it was on the up and up. And then these guys get in debt, and then Chauncey and the mob guys allegedly go to him or them and say, this is how you're going to fix your debt for us. And just two things I want to point out about Chauncey that are in these court files. And one is that on a particular fix that happened, that according to the government, Billups had given the inside information for the fix, they have a money wire that went to Chauncey Billups within 24 hours, $50,000, and it went through a middleman, but the middleman took it from the Gambinos at like 2:50 in the afternoon, and by like 2:55, he had sent it to Billups. So they didn't do a very good job of shielding that money transaction. It looks really bad that 24 hours after this fixed game, you're taking a $50,000 payment from the Gambino crime family. And then they also have the FBI have a text exchange between Chauncey and some of the Gambinos that that text exchange that was happening during one of these fixed games. And these fixed games would take place at, this was, again, this was stuff that the Detroit mob was doing way before any of this. They would get celebrities and mansions and fancy estates to hold these high roller gambling events. They'd get someone like Chauncey to say, hey, come over to this guy's house and we're going to have some fun. And they have a text exchange from in the middle of one of these games where the Gambino was texting Chauncey, who's in the middle of playing poker. And the Gambino is telling Chauncey, you need to tank these next two games because everybody knows that you're cheating. So, I mean, these are pretty incriminating. This is pretty incriminating evidence for the kind of the headline defendant from the athlete angle.
I know Novi knows the saying, but I'm going to throw it out in light of what you just said. And it's really, it's an old time mob saying, and it's this: never write when you can speak, never speak when you can nod, and never nod when you can blink.
Yeah.
If it's in writing, you're screwed.
Right.
It just seems like the $50,000, it just seems like that he could have been a lot savvier in accepting the money from the mob. Than just
that's home run evidence right there.
To have somebody flip it to you within a 5-minute period, it just looks messy. From the perspective,
it looks like very amateurish,
And sloppy.
Yeah,
it's not even. I mean, it's really sloppy and lazy.
Yeah, and then
exactly. That's it too. That's another word for it, is lazy. They're just lazy, too lazy to cover their tracks.
One of the things that I've said to criminals, I didn't invent this, but I've said it to a lot of criminals in my career. I can make 50,000 mistakes, nobody gives a fuck. You make one mistake, you're mine.
Yeah.
You have to live a perfect life if you want to be a criminal. Because nobody cares how many mistakes I make. When you make one mistake, you're done.
Yeah, you're right.
That's simple.
And I don't know if Chauncey didn't realize the depths that he was getting himself into. I don't know how you couldn't have. He was just very brazen and reckless. He picked up one of his co-defendants. We didn't even mention the fact that there's a black mafia family member in this case. It's not just the four of the five families in New York. It's also the BMF, which is the biggest African-American organized crime group in history, based out of Detroit. So not shocking. Chauncey goes and picks up a black mafia family member from prison that had been locked up for 12 years. Chauncey had met him when he was a player. At this point, Chauncey is a coach, and Chauncey goes and picks up, his name is Spooky, and Spooky was a main lieutenant in the Black Mafia family. Chauncey goes and picks Spooky up at the prison walls, and that very night, he drives Pookie to New York City and interjects him into these fixed games as one of his co-conspirators. I mean, it just very, very dumb.
Nope. He's not a criminal.
I agree.
You know, at least the Pistons, when they were shaving, allegedly, it was something the general public didn't know. It was something that was very sly. They were, you know, they were about to be world champions, so you wouldn't think that they would be fixing, but they were doing it with Isaiah Thomas checking himself out of games before tip-off. And they never ended up getting caught for it. They had to go to in front of some grand juries, and the Jackalones got busted for it. And Alan, let's finish off this episode with Novi telling the story of the fact that the Detroit mob had the guy that ran the clock for the Pistons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had the clock. So with a little bit of and the gentleman that had the clock had the timekeeper, always had courtside seats. And when he wanted it to be, as Johnson just say, when he wanted that clock to last a little longer, he blinked three times. And if he wanted the clock to get quickened, he'd blink once. And yeah. All the bookmakers in Detroit knew, don't be betting, don't take the over and under in the Pistons game off the board, because let him go take that to some other city, because we know that clock's bad.
Wow. Well,
and nobody ever figured that one out. We knew it on the streets. Us guys, we knew it. Certain wow. guys knew it, you know.
Any closing remarks, Jamie?
Yeah, I look, this is humiliating for the National Basketball Association. It's humiliating.
They want it to go away. It ain't going away.
They want it to go away. It's not going to go away. And it's been a ghost town in the press. The case yep. came out. And now nobody's talking about it.
Yep.
And when people start talking about this again is when people start going to trial or flipping and cooperating and testifying in grand jury, which is probably going on as we speak.
Right. Well, I just said there's 37 of the actual fixers have in some way, shape, or form cooperated or started to try to cut deals. So it's only a matter of time before this thing, it does explode more than it already has.
But
and there could be more cases.
The one thing you and I talked about is, Scott, it that I would say if anybody asked me is you can't look the American public in the face and say you're serious about preventing this from ever happening again if you don't get rid of prop bets.
You need to get
rid of prop bets. Jamie, I completely agree with you. That prop bet betting is what initiated that greed to come out in people. Yep. And because it's too easy to handle.
And
you don't have to eliminate it. You got to change it a little bit.
No regular everyday better in the 70s, 80s, or 90s had ever heard of a prop bet. This is even terminology that's just come into the mainstream lexicon in the last 10, 15 years. I mean,
well, there were variations of it in the old days. They didn't call them prop bets, but there were variations of it. But they were more honest variations. They weren't as I don't know how they weren't as dependent on one person, one place, one thing that you could buy. I can remember prop bets in baseball going back into the 50s. I remember when they started getting where you bet 10 games on parlays. Those are all prop bets. You remember to get a prop bet, you know, you have to win three or four bets before you get any money. That's what's the advantage to the bookmaker.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for giving us your time. I hope you can come back the next phase of this that we'll probably be seeing at some point in 2026 when either they announce the deals or sure. they announce that they're going to trial or whatever. There'll be a lot. I think there's a lot more chapters to write in this story. Novi and I will always be here to greet you on Original Gangsters Members Only. Thank you so much, Jamie. We owe you a big thank
One
you.
One quick thing. Got to do a shameless plug for my buddy Jeff Kelly's book. Please check it out.
13 Perfect Fugitives, Jeff Kelly. We have an episode that is on Members Only right now that people have been watching over the last week or so, and we're going to be putting it on our YouTube shortly. The story of the Gardner Museum heist, and this is the Bible. And I hope everybody enjoyed the interview we did with Jeff. It was one of my favorite interviews I've ever done with an author and an ex-FBI agent. It's the best book ever written on the Gardner Museum heist in Boston. 36 years now? This last week, weeks ago, 36 years was the anniversary.
That's right.
It's
we busted our ass on it, and the case is still being investigated. But I mean, Jeff just wrote an outstanding book. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about it. So I just wanted to do a shameless plug for my buddy and ex-partner.
Not shameless. Jeff Kelly is a fan of the not a fan. He's a friend of the show. I hope he's a fan. Before we wrap up, Novi, do you have any memory of back in 1990 hearing about the Boston guys going into that museum and taking 13 masterpieces of art?
I remember the case, but I didn't know any details. In 1990, I was incarcerated. I knew a few guys from Boston that knew some of the players.
Now, who did you know? I'm interested to hear it.
We can talk off camera.
Okay.
Thanks, Jamie. This was awesome. Novi, thank you so much. We'll be back shortly at Original Gangsters Members Only. Thank you to Benny for producing, for Novi, for Benny and Jamie. I'm Scott Bernstein. We will see you next time.